Good morning, Africa. Today is Tuesday, March 2nd, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, former French President Nicolas Sarkozy faces 3 years in jail.
The prosecution based its case on wiretap conversation between Sarkozy and his lawyer, Thierry Herzog. The judge and Herzog were also found guilty.
Also ahead, a look at the devastating fentanyl epidemic in the U.S.
A shocking 60% increase in overdose deaths in 2020.
Plus, an attempt to make cargo shipping carbon neutral. These stories and more are next. Our top story today, former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been sentenced to 3 years in jail on charges of influence peddling and trying to bribe a judge. He may appeal the groundbreaking verdict, but he has plenty of other legal troubles ahead, as Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris.
Monsieur Sarkozy?
Former President Nicolas Sarkozy ignored reporters' questions as he left a Paris courthouse Monday. He becomes only the second modern French leader to receive a prison sentence. His predecessor, Jacques Chirac, was handed a year suspended sentence in another corruption trial. But Sarkozy faces a much stiffer penalty, 3 years in prison, two suspended, on charges of seeking to bribe a judge for information. The prosecution based its case on wiretap conversation between Sarkozy and his lawyer, Thierry Herzog. The judge and Herzog were also found guilty. Sarkozy maintains he is innocent. Even if he loses an appeal, he may not have to go to jail, but rather have the choice of wearing an electronic bracelet. He faces plenty of other legal woes, however, including allegations he received millions of dollars from former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to finance his 2007 election campaign, 2011 campaign spending questions, and possible influence peddling linked to Russia after he left office. A staunch conservative, Sarkozy succeeded Chirac as president in 2007, but served only a single term before being defeated by socialist François Hollande in 2012. He also lost another presidential bid in 2017, but saw his popularity rising sharply since announcing his retirement from politics a year later. Gilles Platret, a Sarkozy ally and fellow member of the conservative Les Républicains party, suggested the sentence was biased and Sarkozy would fight it. He told France Info Radio French citizens did not need a trial to know Sarkozy did his job as their president. But the head of the magistrates union saluted the sentence as a sign of an independent judiciary. The conviction does not bar Sarkozy from running for office in the future. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A lawyer for ousted Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi said that a Myanmar court has filed two more charges against her. This as protesters marched in defiance of a crackdown by security forces that killed at least 18 people Sunday. Suu Kyi is the longtime leader of Myanmar's pro-democracy movement, but her international reputation was tarnished when she defended the Myanmar military's bloody 2017 crackdown on Rohingya Muslims. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports on the charges against her.
Protesters in Myanmar were once again out in force on Monday, just a day after the deadliest violence reported since the coup. Yangon was littered with makeshift barricades as riot police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse anti-coup protesters. While on the streets of Mandalay, a dozen kids chanted and marched against the junta. 18 people were killed on Sunday when police opened fire on crowds in various parts of the country. Monday marked the first funerals from the weekend's massacre. Myanmar has been in chaos since the military seized power last month. Citing election fraud, the army detained elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi and dozens of other political leaders. On Monday, Suu Kyi appeared in court via video conference and two more charges were filed against her. Her lawyer, Min Min So, told Reuters that she appeared healthy but may have lost some weight. Suu Kyi was charged under a section of the colonial era penal code, which prohibits the publication of information that may, quote, cause fear or alarm or disrupt, quote, public tranquility. Another charge was added under a telecommunications law, her lawyer said. Suu Kyi has previously been accused of illegally importing walkie-talkie radios and violating a natural disaster law. The UN is calling for the international community to put more pressure on Myanmar's military leaders. Several Western countries have already imposed sanctions. But Myanmar's generals have traditionally shrugged off diplomatic pressure with support from China and Russia.
That was Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. A U.S. spokesman said Sunday that the United States is focused on the future conduct of Saudi Arabia and will expect Riyadh to improve its human rights record. The remarks came after Washington imposed sanctions on some Saudis for the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, but the U.S. fell short of sanctioning the leader believed to be behind the killing, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The U.S. on Friday declassified a report that said the Crown Prince approved an operation in 2018 to capture or kill the journalist. Washington's failure to penalize the Crown Prince has been criticized by rights groups and others, raising questions about accountability and the Biden administration's pledge to make human rights a foreign policy priority. Prince Mohammed is the 35-year-old de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia. He has denied any involvement in Khashoggi's killing, for which 8 people were jailed in Saudi Arabia last year. But he has said that he bears ultimate responsibility because it happened on his watch. A UN pledging conference is seeking $3.85 billion to provide life-saving assistance to 16 million people living on the edge of survival in conflict-ridden Yemen. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says there is no time to lose. He says famine is bearing down on Yemen. He says 16 million people are expected to go hungry this year, noting nearly 50,000 Yemenis already are starving to death in famine-like conditions. He says the brunt of this humanitarian crisis, currently the world's worst, is being borne by the children.
Childhood in Yemen is a special kind of hell. Yemeni children are starving. This year, nearly half of all children under 5 in Yemen are said to suffer from acute malnutrition. The symptoms include wasting, depression, and tiredness. 400,000 of those children face severe acute malnutrition and could die without urgent treatment.
Guterres says starving children are very vulnerable to preventable disease. Every day, he says, Yemeni children are killed or maimed by the conflict. Since the war began in 2014, more than 18,000 civilians have been killed. Last year, the UN reports, more than 2,000 civilians have been killed or maimed. Guterres warns the war is swallowing up a whole generation of Yemenis. He says it has to stop. In the meantime, he notes 2 out of every 3 people in Yemen need food aid, health care, or other life-saving support. These dire needs, he says, are coming at a time when international support for these desperate people has fallen to a new low. He says only $1.9 billion, just half of what is needed, was received last year. And that amount is half of what was received the year before. He says reducing aid is a death sentence for entire families.
This is not the moment to step back from Yemen. We must equal and surpass the levels of funding we had in 2018. I implore all donors to fund our appeal generously to stop famine engulfing the country. Every dollar counts.
The United States heard the Secretary General's plea. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was the first to step up with a pledge.
Today, I'm pleased to announce nearly $191 million in additional humanitarian assistance from the United States, bringing our fiscal year 2021 funding up to more than $350 million. In total, the United States has provided more than $3.4 billion in aid to the Yemeni people since the crisis began 6 years ago.
Blinken appealed to other nations to give generously, especially those in the region. He said it was crucial to act quickly because the economic crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic were making the humanitarian crisis even worse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA. The World Health Organization's emergencies chief says it's premature and unrealistic to think that the COVID-19 pandemic might be stopped by the end of this year. But Dr. Michael Ryan says that the recent arrival of effective vaccines could dramatically reduce hospitalizations and death. Ryan said the world's focus right now should be to keep transmission of COVID-19 as low as possible. WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says it's regrettable that younger and healthier people in rich countries are being vaccinated before at-risk health workers in the developing world. He warns against complacency, noting a recent increase in cases. And in Chad, an opposition leader says he's pulling out of the April presidential election after a deadly raid by security forces on the home of another candidate. Opposition candidate Saleh Kebzabo said he'll withdraw his candidacy after visiting the home of candidate Yaya Dillo, which was assaulted by security forces on Sunday. Dillo says five members of his family were killed in the raid, including his mother, when security forces attempted to arrest him for ignoring a judicial summons. The government says two people died. Kebzabo said on Twitter, quote, "We have leaders unworthy of the Chadian people whose sovereignty they have confiscated. What happened was outright barbarism. I was terrified, disgusted. Chad does not deserve the title of a state. I've always said it's an informal state," end quote. President Idris Deby, who has been in power since 1990, pushed through a new constitution in 2018 that reinstated term limits but could let him stay in power until 2033. Listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. European countries are opening investigations into international adoptions. This after the Netherlands halted the practice because of an inquiry that uncovered fraud, corruption, and trafficking. Marta Vanderwolf reports from London.
Adoptees and rights organizations in other Western European countries are taking action in the wake of the Dutch investigation. Belgium is expecting the outcome of an adoption probe later this year. The social affairs minister in Sweden announced an investigation into adoption practices dating back to the 1960s. Ruli Post says she is not surprised by the assessments in the Dutch report. Post is a former European Union civil servant who became a whistleblower after flagging the issue of illegal adoptions and child trafficking from Eastern Europe more than 20 years ago. Post says she thinks the adoption system cannot go forward in its current form.
After this 60 years, there's no future, not the way it was, perhaps a small number of individual cases, but not an organized market where you have programs and contracts and private adoption agencies. I think that will become a thing of the past.
Marcia Engel is a Dutch adoptee from Colombia. Engel says that when she started to search for her biological family, she realized her mother had been forced to give her up.
In my own case, but also with a lot of adoptees, they were just made on paper an orphan. But in reality, they had family that would like to take care of them.
Engel set up the organization Plan Angel in 2008 to help connect adoptees to their birth families. The organization has engaged with more than 500 cases involving Colombian adoptees. Engel and her organization are helping people adopted by families from North America and Western Europe, as well as domestically. Engel says she sees persistent misconduct, not only with Dutch adoption cases, but with all countries. Engel says she hopes the attention on the subject will help people understand the true nature of many international adoptions.
The general thought about international adoption is that it's a very good thing to help poor children from abroad, to give them a better chance in life. And I think it's also important that people are changing a little bit the narrative about what they think about international adoption, because there is a dark side, and that the dark side is that many biologic families did not voluntarily give up their babies or children.
While this isn't the first time a report has outlined illegal practices within international adoptions, it is the first time a European country is halting such procedures until reforms are made. While the Dutch inquiry focused on Bangladesh, Brazil, Colombia, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka, adoptions from other countries have been halted for now. Countries popular with Western parents for adopting children have been tightening restrictions over the years. Ethiopia banned all foreign adoptions in 2018 following abuse cases reported in the United States. Other countries include Cambodia, Guatemala, and Russia. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
The consumption of fentanyl-laced drugs is on the rise, and so are deadly overdoses in the U.S. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the story.
My husband just passed, so it's kind of still, I'm still trying to get through losing him in daily life.
An overdose took the life of Victoria St. Arnold's husband. For decades, he had used prescription drugs and opioids to ease the throbbing pain from a series of spine surgeries.
I'm assuming he thought that he had just gotten some normal pills. It turned out that it was actually fentanyl.
100 times more potent than morphine, the synthetic opioid fentanyl has expanded its deadly presence in the United States. Just a couple milligrams of fentanyl, like a few flecks of salt, can kill. But mixed with heroin and methamphetamine, it's a huge profit maker for illegal drug dealers who sell it without the user's knowledge. Jared Forjay is the special agent in charge of the Washington Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Because fentanyl is going to make people more addicted to those drugs, and it's cheaper, it's potent, it's more stronger. We're seeing a lot more drug overdoses as a result.
In the 12 months ending last July, more than 86,000 people had died of an overdose in the United States, officials estimate. That is up 24.2%. And in the nation's capital, a shocking 60% increase in overdose deaths in 2020. Psychiatrist Dr. Nora Volkov says the COVID-19 pandemic has made things worse.
Stress is the strongest predictor about whether people are going to take drugs. And what is stressful? The social isolation that we live on, the loss of jobs, the downturn of the economy. It is easy to fall into behaviors that temporarily make you feel better.
Corey Cusimano lost her son to an overdose in 2015. She runs a grief group, social distancing required. She says families can't always afford the medication to reverse an opioid overdose or pay for long-term drug treatment.
Rehab is very expensive. It's anywhere from $6,000 to $14,000 for a 30-day inpatient program. And then after that, they can go into sober living, but they're almost kind of left floundering after that, and there's not that same level of support there.
Now, with the risk of spreading the coronavirus, it's more difficult for people with addiction to get help, especially the poor. Mark Robinson works for the NGO Family and Medical Counseling Service.
The human factor has been taken out because now people have to use mechanical devices, virtual platforms, in an effort to connect with services. Oftentimes they don't have sufficient internet access and even sometimes the knowledge of how to do that. So it's become very impersonal in a genre that requires human touch and human contact.
In a statement to VOA, the White House says the Biden administration is working on solutions based on science and evidence to expand the addiction workforce and fixing racial disparities in drug policy. Also, drug enforcement agencies are scaling up their prevention campaigns and community outreach. Acting U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, Rash Parekh, explains.
Starting with school-age children, if they learn early on all the risks associated with these potent lethal substances, that's going to cut off the demand for these substances. It's about prevention, it's about treatment, and it's about enforcement.
It's also about mental health, says Victoria St. Arnold. Families that risk losing a loved one to drugs need to be tough but compassionate and to take care of themselves as well.
Often they really hate themselves because they know how much they're hurting the people around them. I think they need to know that they're loved, but you still have to be firm. You can't just allow certain behaviors because it's harmful to everybody.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
After fits and starts, Africa's largest vaccination effort has finally begun in South Africa. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa only started rolling out the coronavirus vaccine in the last 2 weeks. But President Cyril Ramaphosa says they've hit the ground running, with more than 67,000 health workers inoculated in the first 10 days as part of the first stage.
The start of our vaccination campaign has so far gone extremely well. It has shown that we can achieve much when we work together as a government, a scientific community, private sector, and community-based organizations. All provinces have established vaccination sites and have put in place plans for the expansion of the program as it will be gaining momentum.
The second phase will start as soon as late April and will include the elderly, essential workers, those who work or live in institutions, and those with other health risks. In all, South Africa hopes to vaccinate 40 million of its nearly 59 million people. Ramaphosa spoke to the nation late Sunday, also announcing that South Africa would drop its viral restrictions to the lowest possible level, level one. The eased regulations still require masks to be worn in public and place limits on alcohol sales and crowd sizes, but represent the most lenient restrictions the country has seen in a year. In all, the nation has seen more than 1.5 million confirmed cases, the highest burden on the continent, and about 50,000 deaths. Dr. Richard Lessels, one of South Africa's top viral researchers, says that he thinks authorities made the right move in stopping use of the AstraZeneca vaccine because it was not found to be entirely effective against the highly contagious variant that has driven most of South Africa's new infections. The nation is switching to a mix of different vaccines, which have shown greater efficacy against the variant, including the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine. And he says South African regulators are looking at other vaccines, including those made in Russia and China. Lessel says South Africa's relatively late start in vaccination wouldn't have impacted the nation's deadly second wave.
Clearly, there was a lot of concern about us being late to the party and late getting started. The reality, however, is that whether we'd got started earlier or not, the vaccination wouldn't have impacted on that second wave that we saw, that really dreadful second wave, because that was already in motion in December. What's critical now is to get vaccine into as many people as possible before any resurgence and any possible third wave.
He also said researchers are working to develop a vaccine against the highly contagious new variant. In Johannesburg, the nation's economic hub, residents this week had mixed feelings about the vaccination campaign. Some said they would be eager to get it as soon as possible, and others expressed concern about the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine, just approved for use in the U.S. The Rainbow Nation has a long road ahead, but says Ramaphosa, this is a country that has known hardship.
So much has changed in our country and in our lives, but the spirit of our people has not changed. You have endured the greatest hardships, but you have remained resolute, united, and hopeful. Now, a year after the virus first reached our shores, we have a much clearer path towards containing infections and ultimately overcoming the disease.
Shot by shot, he says, they'll get it done. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And our last story today, a French company has gone back to the basics of maritime transport with the use of a sailboat to ship cargo to and from France and the Americas. The move aims to make the movement of goods by sea between the two sides of the Atlantic carbon neutral. Francesca Lanag of Reuters reports.
This carbon-neutral sailboat delivered cacao to France all the way from the Dominican Republic. Brittany-based chocolate and coffee manufacturer Grand Desail sent their own vessel, which functions almost completely on renewable energy, on a cross-Atlantic voyage via New York in a bid to make the movement of their goods by sea pollution-free. International shipping by sea transport emits around 940 million tons of CO2 annually, accounting for about 2.2% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. That's according to a 2014 study by the International Maritime Organization. Grander Sail's boat is more environmentally friendly than most cargo ships, featuring two hydro generators, two wind power generators, and three sets of solar panels. Its small diesel motor is only used for minor manoeuvres at harbours. According to Jacques Barrault, the Director General of Grander Sail, the mission was partly inspired by tall ships, a type of sailboat dating back to the 18th century.
It's about making maritime transport carbon neutral again, because we should not forget that in the past, tall ships, which were sailboats, had the capacity to transport cargo, and they didn't have motors. They were already carbon neutral, but we have lost this habit a bit, with the use of large cargo ships and container vessels. And what we're doing with this very modern ship, which really uses today's technology, is that we are reinitiating all of this. We're going back to a more virtuous maritime transport, and it's true that it's something that's extremely important considering all of today's environmental matters.
The sailboat started its maiden voyage in November 2020 and docked in New York City in December. It then set off to the Dominican Republic, where staff collected 33 tons of cacao beans before heading back to France, making a total round trip of 3 months. During the voyage, the crew enjoyed Brittany's trademark crepes, lying in the hammock and spotting the occasional dolphin swimming nearby. But it wasn't all plain sailing, said the boat's captain, Loic Briand.
We took a route around the north, all the while staying close to the Gulf Stream. We had a bit of depression, 4 anticyclones, and we chose to test the boat in some depressions, which meant we faced storms with wind speeds of up to 120 kilometers per hour and 7 to 8 meter waves that came crashing down. But the boat resisted well.
The company aims to develop an inter-Atlantic network of cacao and coffee producers in the future with the implementation of more cargo sailboats.
Little by little, we'll develop on both sides of the Atlantic a manufacturing network of roasting and chocolate production, both on the European level and in the east coast of the United States. Then we'll eventually link these sites together with one cargo sailboat, then a second sailboat, a third, a fourth, so that this group of ships could serve each site in a pooled manner.
Thanks to Reuters' Francesca Lanag for that report. And that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Israel and Kosovo have formally established diplomatic relations, following through on the decision for mutual recognition made in September 2020 and announced at the time at the White House. Because of COVID-19 precautions, Kosovo Foreign Minister Meliza Haradinaj-Stubla and Israeli Foreign Minister Gabriel Ashkenazi signed the deal in a virtual ceremony on February 1st. State Department spokesperson Ned Price called it an historic day.
Deeper international ties help promote stability, peace, and prosperity in both regions. When our partners are united, the United States is stronger.
In the past year, several other Muslim-majority and Arab countries have established new ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan, which normalized relations with Israel in the fall of 2020. In December, Morocco and Israel signed a joint declaration pledging cooperation in a number of areas and agreed to move to full diplomatic relations in the near future. Spokesperson Price told reporters that the United States is hoping to build on the progress that has been made in normalizing relations with Israel and other countries.
And the United States will continue to urge other countries to normalize relations with Israel, and will look for other opportunities to expand cooperation among countries in the region.
He warned, however, that normalization between Israel and other countries is not a substitute for Israeli-Palestinian peace. We hope, he said, that as Israel and other countries in the region join together in a common effort to build bridges and create new avenues for dialogue and exchange, these efforts contribute to tangible progress towards the goal of advancing a negotiated peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
That was an editorial.